the northern panel this afternoon, State versus Sample, case number 71208. Justice Stiglitz is in another commitment, but will be participating in the disposition of this case after she's had an opportunity to listen to the arguments today. Are counsel ready to proceed?
The state is ready, Your Honor.
Okay.
The respondent is also ready, Your Honor.
All right, very good. Let's go ahead then.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Noble and I represent the state of Nevada. Before I begin, may I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Would the court like me to recite the facts of this case or move straight to argument?
Well, I do think that, of course, Justice Perry-Gary can speak for himself as he customarily does, but I think one of the areas factually that may be useful in the court's evaluation of this case, and ask both counsel to address it, is the circumstances surrounding the placement of Mr. Sample in the car, and whether that constitutes an effective arrest, even though the officer apparently did not announce that he was under arrest, and what impact, if any, that has on the issues in this case.
Certainly, Justice Hardesty, I have planned on incorporating that into my analysis of that issue. If that's all right, I will talk
about
those facts. Thank you. Unlike many cases that have come before this court, undoubtedly in one way or another, after Missouri versus McNeely, this case does not involve the warrantless seizure of blood from a suspected DUI driver. In fact, in this case, the officers obtained a seizure order telephonically, and then blood was withdrawn from Mr. Sample based on his prior history of felony DUI. What is at issue, of course, is what occurred before that. And the district court, of course, found that the preliminary breath test was an illegal warrantless search of Mr. Sample. And it also found that absent the result, which was 0.172 of that PBT, there was not probable cause to support the arrest. Now, with respect to the arrest, that was based on the misapprehension, the state believes, that whether or not someone is under arrest is determined by the officer's intent or opinion at that time. The second error that the state's asserting is that in evaluating the probable cause absent the preliminary breath test result, the court put too much emphasis on the deputy's analysis of whether or not he had probable cause. So, moving to the first issue, the trial court concluded that at the time Mr. Sample was directed to go into the preliminary breath testing device, he was not under arrest, and so that was a violation of Birchfield versus North Dakota, which of course stands for the proposition that that's similar to a search of the person, that it could be a search incident to a lawful arrest and therefore not required to have a warrant. The state alleges that this is an error based on the facts. Prior to blowing into the instrument, this is what happened. Mr. Sample is pulled over using lights and a brief siren. He eventually pulls over into a private driveway, which turns out to be his home. Initially, he rolls down the window partially, is reluctant to get out of the vehicle, and the officer reaches through the partially open window and opens the door, and the deputies who have now arrived, cover deputies, assist Mr. Sample out of the vehicle. And he's somewhat cooperative at that time. What happens next is that, of course, and I'll talk about that in the next part of my argument, but they observe a niche of intoxication, and there's also an admission to drinking. At some point during the encounter, Mr. Sample attempts to walk away from the officers, and they believe in the direction of his home. At that point, he is restrained, put in a what they call a rear wrist lock, handcuffed, and put in the back of a police car. Now, under McKellips, of course, what the officer might say about whether or not somebody was under arrest or whether they told them they were under arrest is, of course, a factor, but it's not necessarily dispositive. We look, of course, at all of the objective indicia of arrest, and it's the state's position that those were present in this case. The person was restrained in movement, they were seized, they were placed in handcuffs. Prior to that, they were placed in a wrist lock or some sort of hold and stuck in the back of a police car. And so certainly, if he had been asked incriminating questions at that point, absent Miranda, we would not be arguing about whether or not he was under arrest. So it's the state's position that indeed he was under arrest, and so the breath test that was administered, the roadside breath test, was a search incident to an arrest. It doesn't matter if arrest had been declared, and it also doesn't matter whether or not the deputy thought the guy was under arrest. The district court in its order focused a lot on the variance in the deputy's testimony between the DMV hearing and the evidentiary hearing. And by the way, I'll concede that it definitely varied. And we are not disputing here today the district court's findings of facts in its order. The state, for purposes of this appeal, stipulates to those facts. Moving to the second issue, which is the district court's conclusion that without that preliminary breath test result, there was no probable cause. The state, of course, argues that that's an objective standard. We ask, is there reasonably trustworthy information based on all the facts and circumstances to warrant an officer of reasonable caution, a reasonable person, to think that this person has committed a crime? And based on other facts, which I'll share with the court now, it's the state's position that indeed those were present. The deputy testified that he observed the odor of alcohol coming from the vehicle initially. Actually, let me back up. Let's talk about the driving pattern, because that's important. We have the driving pattern wherein Mr. Sample crosses a fog line and then seems to accelerate, briefly crosses into a turning lane that's reserved for traffic going the opposite direction, southbound traffic. The deputy testified that it was 35 miles an hour in terms of the speed limit, and he had to go between 55 and 70, he's a little inconsistent, to catch up with Mr. Sample, though he did not pace him or use a radar. When he eventually pulls Mr. Sample over, which doesn't happen immediately after he activates his lights, but it does happen after the siren is briefly activated, he encounters him. Like I just said, he has the odor of alcohol coming from the car. When Mr. Sample exits the vehicle, the deputy can clearly see he has the odor of alcohol coming from his person. His eyes are red and watery. He observes slurred speech. He has a difficulty keeping his balance a little bit. He kind of holds himself up on the car just a little bit. And he's uncooperative. And that uncooperative behavior actually starts while he's still in the vehicle. He's drinking something from, we don't know what it is, some sort of clear liquid, and the deputy has to tell him at least three times, put that down. And even then, he picks it up another time. So based on all those facts and circumstances, the state's position is that there's probable cause, with or without a preliminary breath test, to believe that this person was under the influence of alcohol.
And there was no field sobriety test done here because the officer determined that he was uncooperative and perhaps too unsteady?
Yes. Thank you for the question, Justice Perrier. It's my understanding from the record that he wasn't excessively uncooperative, but they did have some concerns about officer safety and his own safety, but I don't think his unsteadiness was one of the factors in not doing the field sobriety tests. But in answering your question, I'd also note that while field sobriety tests are something that police use to determine whether or not somebody's under the influence, there's no authority that requires them to be administered. They're just one factor that can support probable cause. I see I'm starting to run out of time, so I'd like to also address the issue that was raised as to whether or not the state reserved the argument concerning when arrest occurred for purposes of appeal. The state will stipulate that in the pleadings, in the opposition to the motion to suppress, the trial deputy didn't argue that Mr. Sample was under arrest at the time the preliminary breath test was issued. It's always been the state's position, however, that this was not unlawful pursuant to Birchfield versus North Dakota. Now, I don't think this is a problem for this court to consider, and here's why. Mr. Sample's counsel cites the Herman case and the Liu case, talking about when we don't raise issues below, it's inappropriate for this court to consider on appeal. Well, generally that's true, but in this case, this issue was considered by the district court. The order, around page 129 of the record, talks about specifically when this arrest occurred, and instead of applying, it cites the general standard for what we look at for arrest, but there's so much emphasis on what the deputy testified. Was the guy under arrest? Was he not? And the state's position that there was an inappropriate focus on that. With that, Your Honor, I see I'm just about 5 minutes.
Asking us to second guess the district court's assessment of whether he was under arrest or not?
Justice Hardesty, yes, I am, in the sense that I certainly am not taking issue with the factual findings that underlie that, but the application of the law was not the correct one. The correct standard was recited but not applied, and I think that's evident from the analysis in the order.
Well, I don't see much discussion in her findings regarding the pre-BBT conduct, driving, indicia of alcohol use, that would have might have provided a basis for a search warrant independent of the PVD test.
Justice Hardesty, my recollection of the record is that those facts were discussed during the evidentiary hearing, and I guess what I would point to is that although those facts were elicited during the hearing, there's an absence of analysis, there's an emphasis on the deputy's subjective intent or opinion, and that's overemphasized.
So on page 123 of the record, page 2 of the order, lines 12 through 23, the district court recites the officer's testimony and observations, many of which are consistent with what you've represented here concerning speed and fog lane and the like. Your contention then, or your argument, is that the district court committed error in failing to evaluate those factors in determining whether they would have supported independently the request for the search warrant?
That's part of the state's position. Yes, Justice Hardesty.
All right. And the rest of the other part?
Okay, I see I'm running out of time, but
I'll give you some additional time.
Thank you, I appreciate that. So the other part is that even though all these factors suggesting arrest are available, there is discussion about the variance between the testimony at the DNA hearing and the evidentiary hearing. And
that variance seems to focus on whether the officer, when and whether the officer declared he was under arrest.
That's definitely what's being discussed, but there's a conclusion in the order that this was not a search incident to arrest because the person was not under arrest at the time the PBT was administered. And so I think inherent in that analysis is the assumption that the deputy's view of whether or not the person was under arrest carries the
on that point is, regardless of what the officer declared or didn't declare, the facts support the conclusion legally that the individual was under arrest.
Yes, Justice Hardesty, that is the state's position.
Okay, I'll give you 2 minutes on your rebuttal and you'll have 17 minutes, Ms. Dunn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Karina Dunn. I'm here along with Larry Dunn. We are both counsel for Mr. Gregory Sample. Your Honor, I would like to first, I believe, address what was just last addressed with Ms. Noble, and particularly having to do with this arrest issue. One of the reasons why in our briefs that we pointed out that we believed that this was an issue that was being brought up for the first time on appeal is because I believe that the state is confusing, and maybe not Ms. Noble personally, but when this occurred on the trial level, the state's counsel conceded that he was not under arrest, conceded that he was not under arrest when they took the PBT, when the deputy took the PBT. In addition to that, while I certainly understand the court's concern over the arrest issue, because of course I think it is an important one, the whole focus of the motion to suppress and on the arguments on the state level having to do, in the lower court, having to do with whether or not this breath test could have been given or should have been given, all revolved around voluntariness as to whether or not there was actual consent to this PBT, because there were questions about that. As the court may have noticed from the record, there was a variance on the deputy's testimony at the DMV, at the applying for the search warrant, and then also at the evidentiary hearing, to include in his report, there was a variance as to whether or not this particular individual, Mr. Sample, actually consented to this preliminary breath test. And so the focus, whether or not he was under arrest, and then of course whether or not he consented, there was variance on the testimony from the officer. And so that's the reason why we wanted to point out that this was not brought up on at the lower court. The focus of the state's position was on whether or not this particular PBT was consensual.
So your argument on this point is that even if legally incorrect, the state's concession that he was not under arrest should form the basis of our evaluation of this appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's two ways I believe that we should look at it. First, that I do believe that the state conceded this issue and it was not brought up, it wasn't brought up as far as whether or not he was under arrest until the appeal. But second, Your Honor, that's where I was going to go next, is to explain why, even based upon the actual facts and circumstances surrounding, as the court first asked, the first question they asked, surrounding this arrest, surrounding what happened prior to the PBT, what happened after the PBT, and everything having to do with around when he was placed into the back of the vehicle. And I think even based upon all those factors, I believe that the trial court, certainly we don't know how she would have ruled had that issue been addressed on the lower level, but what we do know is that based upon the trial court's order, she found that he was not under arrest at the time that the PBT was given. Aside from that, there are some indicia that I think is very important as to why a reasonable person, even looking at it from the objective standard, would still find that there wasn't an arrest. For one thing, as not only did the officer never indicate to Mr. Sample that he was under arrest, to the contrary, he actually advised Mr. Sample that he was not under arrest. That actually came out during the testimony of the officer, where he said that that he was not under arrest. So despite the fact that Mr. Sample was being placed into handcuffs based upon the fact that he had tried to walk back to the residence twice on these officers, and there was more than one officer on the scene, and so he kept moseying on back, as it were, back towards the residence. And so the officer, after the second time, that's when he finally said, come here, walked him back to the patrol car, put him in handcuffs, and put him in the back of the police car.
Well, doesn't that make it pretty clear that Mr. Sample is not free to go anywhere?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Your Honor, and I think that there's certainly a different level of detention, right? There's certainly different levels of detention. He was detained based upon a traffic stop, and then at that point, there was a detention that he was going to then continue an investigation, started asking questions about whether or not he'd been drinking and started going through the DUI investigation. But then when Mr. Sample was not following the directions, then the officer indicated that he put him in handcuffs and put him in the back of the police car and told Mr. Sample that he wasn't under arrest. Then he continued on with the investigation. So it wasn't as though he simply put him in the back of the patrol car, gathered up his stuff, and then...
In a Fourth Amendment context, would you argue that Mr. Sample had just been seized?
Correct.
Just as... And under a Fifth Amendment context, would you argue that Mr. Sample, if interrogated, would have to receive his Miranda rights?
Probably. And maybe that's an attorney's answer. You know, Your Honor, because...
So, I understand your point, particularly the point that you emphasize about the concession by trial counsel. Treat that as a separate issue.
Yes.
But it does seem that your position asks this court to establish a different test for evaluating whether someone is under arrest when they're sitting in a police car with handcuffs on and not free to go, than the test we would normally apply for Fourth and Fifth Amendment determinations. How would one articulate that in a published opinion?
Your Honor, I think, I don't even know that I would necessarily be asking for a different standard. I believe that based upon the facts and circumstances of this case, even if the court found, and there, I think that there are additional indicia to show that he was not under arrest. And so I don't even know that it would, obviously, under an abundance of caution, I believe that if an officer places an individual in handcuffs in the back of a patrol car or next to the patrol car or anything like that, certainly being in that next...
Well, true. He wasn't, you would agree, he wasn't placed in the patrol car for officer safety.
I do not believe it was for officer safety. I believe that he was not following the directions of the officer, and the officer wanted to contain him while they continued the investigation.
So that necessarily compels the court to ask, any court, why is he, in effect, in custody? I mean, isn't that the key question? Is he in custody?
Your Honor, I think that there are many times where we see cases where the fact pattern would consist of an individual who gets pulled over under what they what commonly referred to as a felony stop, where for whatever reason they get a report of potential dangerous activity or something like that, where they actually, officers pull up on an individual, pull them out at gunpoint, sometimes even at that point tell them to, you know, walk backwards to the sound of their voice or get on their knees, so the officer can then take the individual into custody or further detention, I guess would be the better word, would be put them under that detention to then investigate what it is as the reason why they stopped the individual. So, Your Honor, I believe that he was still detained. I would not use the word custody. And I guess the concern that I had was when I said that whether or not an individual should be read as Miranda rights, I do that. I don't know. I do not believe legally we would be arguing if an individual simply, if an officer put him in handcuffs, put him in the back of a patrol car, and then started just peppering him with questions as far as the investigation goes, asking questions, eliciting answers, going through that normal interrogation, as it were, test. I certainly think that there may be an issue, but those I think would be different facts. Because I think these facts lend themselves, because of what the officers did, how the officers acted, where they continued the investigation. The officer repeatedly asked the individual, Mr. Sample, to take a preliminary breath test over and over. So again, continuing the investigation. In addition to that, they took the time to get the preliminary breath test. They ended up having to go through two different preliminary breath test devices to see if they would occur. This all occurred after Mr. Sample was in the back of the patrol car. So Mr. Sample, or an objective person in general, as they're sitting there, when the officer simply put him in the back of the patrol car, told him, you're not under arrest, and then continued to try to continue the investigation through many routes, getting the preliminary breath test, continually asking Mr. Sample to consent to or to take the preliminary breath test, I believe that certainly it could, from an objective standpoint, a reasonable person being told that he was not under arrest, going through the process of the preliminary breath test, going through all that, I believe that a reasonable person could very much believe that based upon what the officer advised him of, this reasonable person, that they would have been free to go had the investigation worked out in their favor. Just like in the typical DUI investigation. The problem was that this officer wanted to contain Mr. Sample because he kept wandering back to his home. And so I believe that he was not under arrest at that time. Based upon that, I believe that an objective person can find them based upon the facts and circumstances. And I believe that listening to the testimony of the officer, reviewing the basis, even though this particular issue was not brought up to the judge, and nor do I think that the judge, although made a finding that he was not under arrest at the time that the PBT was administered, that was very much, I think, based upon both her interpretation of the testimony, based upon the concession of the state, and the testimony of the officer. And so with that, Your Honor, with the arrest issue, if Mr. Sample, if this court, as the lower court did, found that Mr. Sample was not under arrest, then went and asked him, having to do with the preliminary breath test, asked him to take the preliminary breath test, Birchfield would apply. And the reason Birchfield is so important in this case is the Supreme Court in Birchfield announced that a PBT, a preliminary breath test, was a search. I don't think that's ever been argued by the state. I believe that the state believes also, excuse me, they said a breath test is a search. They didn't specify a preliminary breath test. Birchfield said that a breath test was a search, and based upon their analysis under the Fourth Amendment, and therefore you needed consent, warrant, or a established exception. And the court in Birchfield found that the established exception would have been search incident to an arrest. Now, the Supreme Court could have found that all breath tests are, they could have found that they weren't searches, but that wasn't what happened. They did find that they were a search. And so with this preliminary breath test being, and there's another issue, Your Honor, preliminary breath tests are specifically by statute to be used simply for probable cause. And so we end up in a position where with Birchfield, and I don't know that the state's necessarily arguing that Birchfield would apply to a preliminary breath test, and therefore, meaning that it is a search, it's Fourth Amendment, you need consent, a warrant, or a exception, establishes that exception to the warrant requirement.
How did the officer explain his discrepancy in testimony as it related to consent at the DMV hearing and the information he gave the judge getting the search warrant as opposed to the hearing, the suppression hearing?
I believe that based upon the suppression hearing, it came out on cross-examination at the suppression hearing that he did not ask Mr. Sample to take it. He told him to blow into this, and that ultimately he said that never asked him, just told him to blow into this, and therefore never had his consent. Explaining away his discrepancies was one of the biggest issues having to do with this officer, and ultimately this judge finding the way she did. This judge was, the lower court judge was very concerned about the discrepancies, and that goes to the issue of whether or not there was actually probable cause without the preliminary breath testing device.
He did testify that that wasn't his purpose in giving the breath test wasn't for probable cause.
Although he did, and I apologize, Your Honor, I don't remember at which location of the of his testimony, whether it was for the warrant or for DMV or others, because at one point he said he did not have probable cause prior to the preliminary breath testing device. At another hearing, he said that, you know, I wasn't giving him a PBT for probable cause. So again, there was a discrepancy.
So let me ask you this. Why isn't the telephonic search warrant approved by Judge Hasjeff sufficient to allow admission of the blood draw? According to the judge's order, while the officer did in fact reference the PBD test in his conversation with Judge Hasjeff, he also recited under oath the facts of the investigatory stop. Why wouldn't the facts surrounding the investigatory stop, as outlined in the judge's factual findings, provide a sufficient basis for Judge Hasjeff to issue the search warrant and allow admission of the blood draw, even if we accept all of your arguments with respect to the PBT?
Your Honor, I believe that once you have an illegal arrest where the author, where judge, the lower court judge, Judge Simons, found that based upon the testimony of the officer, based upon review of everything, that she believed that the officer did not have probable cause to place him under arrest. And so if you have an illegal arrest and then you, then it's difficult to get probable cause after the fact. I understand.
The trouble I'm having is that with respect to that argument, I get your point earlier that the trial counsel conceded that there was no arrest. But for purposes of assessing Judge Hasjeff's evaluation of probable cause, the officer appears to have, and the trial judge here appears to have accepted, that both the issue of the PBT test and the facts surrounding the investigatory stop were submitted to the Justice of the Peace, and why wouldn't the investigatory stop facts provide sufficient basis for the issuance of the warrant?
I believe that it did provide sufficient for the issuance of the warrant based upon what that judge knew at that time. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, once we were up in district court and we were basically raising the issue, specifically that this officer did not have probable cause to place Mr. Sample under arrest. And what the trial court was able to do at that level, she was able to assess the credibility and the accuracy of the officer, reviewing all of his testimony to include that testimony, and ultimately found that she simply had a lot of trouble believing the officer's testimony.
Did she actually indicate that in the order and make any credibility determinations?
Your Honor, twice in the order, she states that the record belies the testimony of the officer. Twice. And so I do believe that that's an issue. And that's one of the reasons why, and I'm sure this court on many occasions has found that they do not want to second guess a trial court because they're the ones that are able to assess the credibility, the accuracy, the testimony at that time. If for an appellate court to address those issues.
So one question I had for you, I'm sorry for interrupting.
You're fine, Judge.
Oh, thank you. I don't quite read the order as broadly as maybe you do, so this is why I wanted to ask you this. In addressing whether the search warrant was invalid, the court says this. The court finds Deputy Swanson's reliance upon the telephonic search warrant was not objectively reasonable because he used results of the non-consensual PBT as a basis for the telephonic search warrant in violation of the applicable law, period. The judge says nothing about the investigatory stop facts that were submitted to the Justice of the Peace. Has the judge committed error? What I'm concerned about as I read this order, it looks to me like the trial judge is extending the exclusionary rule from the PBT
to the search warrant evidence, and that's troubling. Could you comment?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I certainly understand the court's concern, because simply stating that whether or not if a PDT was illegally used based upon some Fourth Amendment violation, does everything fall thereafter, right? And so I certainly understand your concern. And I think, although I see where you're talking about in the order, she does also address the fact that based upon the totality of the circumstances and her assessment of this officer, of the testimony, of the record that she had it, that she did not believe, absent the preliminary breath test result, that the officer had probable cause. And so I don't believe that it's necessarily stating that, and maybe not worded perfectly, I understand that, but ultimately I believe that had the PDT been illegally given, yet the court had found that there was probable cause to arrest, I do not believe that this court would have found, the lower court would have said, okay, then all of the blood results go out.
Does Mr. Sample contend that the facts surrounding the investigatory stop were not conveyed to Judge Hastjeff by Deputy Swanson?
No, we do not. Mr. Sample does not contend that.
Okay. Did you want to wrap up with any final comment?
Quick final comment, Your Honor, just to wrap it up, and ultimately we didn't get too much into the probable cause issue with the whether or not it was an objective standard. I believe that we pointed that in our brief, and we pointed that in where the order talks about an objective standard. But ultimately, Your Honor, if based upon the facts and circumstances of this case, there was a PDT that was in violation of the Fourth Amendment based upon the Birchfield case, basically, ultimately, and then this individual, the deputy, gave the preliminary breath testing device. After that, with that illegal breath test, is there probable cause to support the arrest? And I believe that the lower court found that there was not, and I believe that this court, in many cases, have shied away from wanting to second guess what happened in that room, in that courtroom, at an evidentiary hearing. And I believe that the state is asking this court to do that in this case. And I believe that this court would need to find error by the court in order to do that. And I do not believe that the state has shown that. And for those reasons, we would ask that the decision by the lower court stand.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Ms. Noble?
I wanted to first talk about the question of whether or not the judge found, in general, that the deputy was an incredible witness. That's nowhere in that order, and I note that many of the facts and the factual recitation contained in the order are taken straight from the deputy's testimony. I also note for this court that in the DMV transcript, he testifies that I believe this is his sixth or seventh DUI investigation or arrest. So we have an officer who's testifying about what are really legal concepts of arrest and consent. His testimony varies, and we can see that. I think that it's evident from the order that Judge Simon saw that as well. I didn't find his testimony to be incredible as
what
a matter.
What did the state do to rehabilitate him with several of those issues where he had conflicting testimony?
In reading the transcript, I mean, there are problems trying to do that for the trial prosecutor. I mean, you have testimony in black and white at a hearing the state's not present at, where he's saying one thing about when he thought the person was under arrest and when there was probable cause, and then he's saying something different. It's difficult to rehabilitate a witness as to that issue when you have variances in the testimony. And that's why, for purposes of this appeal, we're certainly not contending that there were not. And with respect to the findings of fact that the district court made, we're not contesting those.
What about the concession that counsel was speaking about the statement.
With respect to the not being under arrest at the time?
Yes.
Thank you for the question, Justice Perry. So, in the opposition to the motion to suppress, and this is at about page 39 of the record, the state says that Mr. Sample's reliance on Birchfield versus North Dakota is misplaced because that had to do with a post-arrest or incident-to-arrest breath test administration. So that's there. Then we have the evidentiary hearing where prosecutor has the benefit of actually hearing the testimony from the officer. And if you look at pages 111 to 113 of the prosecutor's argument at that hearing, she doesn't take that position. In fact, she doesn't really take any position at all on it. However, I would say that the issue has definitely been considered by this court. If you look at page 126 of the record, that's the portion of the order wherein Judge Simons is analyzing Birchfield and its application. And in doing that, the arrest analysis has to come into play. Because if the person was under arrest, then it's a search incident to arrest under Birchfield, and there's no problem. So the judge took those facts that she found in the statement of facts, and then she considered specifically the issue of whether or not those facts supported the concept of whether or not this individual was under arrest at the time the PBT was administered. So that issue was considered by the court. And she does talk about pages 127 to 128, talking about how there are actually facts that might be consistent with arrest, but comes to the conclusion that, the deputy said he wasn't under arrest. And again, we can see that is one factor that can be considered under McKellips. I also want to touch upon an issue, and the question is whether or not, if I may continue.
Just finish your thought.
Thank you. The preliminary breath test is not something that's required for probable cause. This deputy was operating under the old statute in 2015, which had not been adjusted post-McNeely. This has to do with whether or not, under pre-McNeely, we have good grounds to go do a warrantless blood draw, which we now know is unconstitutional.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Noble. Ms. Gunn, thank you very much for your excellent arguments today and your briefing in this matter, and the case will stand submitted.